nodded. "The bomb," he said. "The bomb," Prax agreed. Even when they didn't know that the second thing was going to get loose, they'd outfitted it with a powerful incendiary explosive device.
"Ah," Alex said, "I get it. You figure they knew it was going to go off the rails eventually, so they wired it to blow if it got out of hand."
In the depths of space, a construction welder streaked across the hull of the half-built ship, the light of its flare casting a sudden, sharp light across the pilot's eager face. "Yes," Prax said, "but it could also be an ancillary weapon, or a payload that the thing was supposed to deliver. I think it's a fail-safe. It probably is, but it could be any number of other things."
"Okay, but it left it behind," Alex said.
"Given time, it ejected the bomb," Prax said. "You see? It chose to reconfigure itself to remove the payload. It didn't place it to destroy the Rossi, even though it could have. It didn't deliver it to a preset target. It just decided to pop it loose."
"And it knew to do that?"
"It's smart enough to recognize threat," Prax said. "I don't know the mechanism yet. It could be cognitive or networked or some kind of modified immune response."
"Okay, Prax. So if the protomolecule can eventually get out of whatever constraints they're putting on it and go rogue, where does that get us?" Naomi asked.
"Square one," Prax thought, and launched in on the information he'd intended to give them in the first place. "It means that wherever the main lab is, the place they didn't release one of those things on, it has to be close enough to Ganymede to get it there before it slipped its leash. I don't know how long that is, and I'm betting they don't either. So closer is better."
"A Jovian moon or a secret station," Holden said.
"You can't have a secret station in the Jovian system," Alex said. "There's too much traffic. Someone would see something. Shit, it's where most of the extrasolar astronomy was going on until we got out to Uranus. Put something close, the observatories are going to get pissed because it's stinking up their pictures, right?"
Naomi tapped her fingers against the tabletop, the sound like the ticking of condensate falling inside sheet metal vents.
"Well, the obvious choice is Europa," she said.
"It's Io," Prax said, impatience slipping into his voice. "I used some of the money to get a tariff search on the kinds of aerolamines and nitroarenes that you use for mutagenic research." He paused. "It's all right that I did that, isn't it? Spent the money?"
"That's what it's there for," Holden said.
"Okay, so mutagens that only start functioning after you activate them are very tightly controlled, since you can use them for bioweapons research. But if you're trying to work with that kind of biological cascade and constraint systems, you'd need them. Most of the supplies went to Ganymede, but there was a steady stream to Europa, too. And when I looked at that, I couldn't find a final receiver listed. Because they shipped back out of Europa about 2 hours after they landed."
"Bound for Io," Holden said.
"It didn't list a location, but the shipping containers for them have to follow Earth and Mars safety specifications. Very expensive. And the shipping containers for the Europa shipment were returned to the manufacturer for credit on a transport bound from Io." Prax took a breath. It had been like pulling teeth, but he was pretty sure he'd made all the points he needed to for the evidence to be, if not conclusive, at least powerfully suggestive.
"So," Amos said, drawing the word out to almost 3 syllables, "the bad guys are probably on Io?"
"Yes," Prax said.
"Well, shit, Doc, could have just said so."
The thrust gravity was a full G, but without the subtle Coriolis of Tycho Station. Prax sat in his bunk, bent over his hand terminal. There had been times on the journey to Tycho Station when being half-starved and sick at heart were the only things that distracted him.
Nothing physical had changed. The walls were still narrow and close. The air recycler still clicked and hummed. Only now, rather than feeling isolated, Prax felt he was in the center of a vast network of people, all bent toward the same end that he was. Mr. Meng, I saw the report on you, and my heart and prayers are with you. I'm sorry I can't send money because I'm on basic, but I have included the report in my church newsletter. I hope you can find your daughter safe and healthy. Prax had composed a form letter for responding to all the general well-wishers, and he'd considered trying to find a filter that could identify those messages and reply automatically with the canned response. He held off, because he wasn't sure how well he could define the conditions set, and he didn't want anyone to feel that their sentiments were being taken for granted. And, after all, he had no duties on the Rocinante. I'm writing you because I may have information that will help with the quest to reclaim your daughter. Since I was very young, I have had powerful premonitions in my dreams. And 3 days before I saw James Holden's article about you and your daughter, I saw her in a dream. She was on Luna, in a very small place without light, and she was scared. I tried to comfort her, but I feel sure now that you are meant to find her on Luna, or in a nearby orbit. Prax didn't respond to everything, of course. The journey to Io wouldn't take much more time than the one to Tycho had. Probably less, since they were unlikely to have the chaos of a stowaway protomolecule construct blowing out the cargo bay this time. If Prax thought about it too long, it made his palm itch. He knew where she was, or where she had been. Every hour was bringing him closer, and every message flowing into his charitable account gave him a little more power. Someone else who might know where Carlos Marion was and what he was doing. There were a few he'd set up conversations with, mostly video conversations sent back and forth. He'd spoken with a security broker based out of Ceres Station, who'd run some of his tariff searches and seemed like a genuinely nice man. He'd exchanged a few video recordings with a grief counselor on Mars before he started to get an uncomfortable feeling that she was hitting on him. An entire school of children, at least 100 of them, had sent him a recording of them singing a song in mixed Spanish and French in honor of May and her return. Intellectually, he knew that nothing had changed. The chances were still very good that May was dead, or at least that he would never see her again. But to have so many people, and in such a steady stream, telling him that it would be all right, that they hoped it would be all right, that they were pulling for him, made despair less possible. It was probably something like group reinforcement effect. It was something common to some species of crop plant. An ill or suffering plant could be moved into a community of well members of the species and, through proximity, improve, even if soil and water were supplied separately. Yes, it was chemically mediated, but humans were social animals, and a woman smiling up from the screen, her eyes seeming to look deeply into your own, and saying what you wanted to believe was almost impossible to wholly disbelieve. It was selfish, and he knew that. But it was also addictive. He'd stopped paying attention to the donations that were coming in once he knew there was enough to fund the ship as far as Io. Holden had given him an expense report and a detailed spreadsheet of costs, but Prax didn't think Holden would cheat him, so he'd barely glanced at anything other than the total at the bottom. Once there was enough money, he'd stopped caring about money. It was the commentary that took his time and attention. He heard Alex and Amos in the galley, their voices calm and conversational. It reminded him of living in the group housing at university, the awareness of other voices, other presences, and the comfort that came from those familiar sounds. It wasn't that different from reading the comment threads.
I lost my son 4 years ago, and I still can't imagine what you are going through right now. I wish there was more I could do. He had the list down to only a few dozen. It was mid-afternoon in the arbitrary world of ship time, but he was powerfully sleepy. He debated leaving the remaining messages until after a nap, and decided to read through them without requiring himself to respond to each one. Alex laughed. Amos joined him. Prax opened the fifth message.
You are a sick, sick, sick motherfucker, and if I ever see you, I swear to God I will kill you myself. People like you should be raped to death just so you know what it feels like.
Prax tried to catch his breath. The sudden ache in his body was just like the aftermath of being punched in the solar plexus. He deleted the message. Another came in, and then three more, and then a dozen. With a sense of dread, Prax opened one of the new ones.
I hope you die.
I don't understand, Prax said to the terminal.
The vitriol was sudden and constant and utterly inexplicable. At least, it was until he opened one of the messages that had the link to a public news feed. Prax put in a request, and 5 minutes later his screen went blank. The logo of one of the big Earth-based news aggregators glowed briefly in blue, and the title of the feed series, The Raw Feed, appeared. When the logo faded out, Nicola was looking out at him. Prax reached for the controls, part of his mind insisting that he'd somehow slipped into his private messages, even as the rest of him knew better. Nicola licked her lips, looked away, then back at the camera. She looked tired, exhausted. My name's Nicola Mulco. I used to be married to Praxidiki Meng, the man who put out a call for help finding our daughter, my daughter, May. A tear dripped down her cheek, and she didn't wipe it away. What you don't know, what no one knows, is that Praxidiki Meng is a monster of a human being. Ever since I got away from him, I've been trying to get May back. I thought his abuse of me was between us. I didn't think he'd hurt her. But information has come back to me from friends who stayed on Ganymede after I left that...
Nicola, Prax said, don't do this.
Praxidiki Meng is a violent and dangerous man, Nicola said. As May's mother, I believe that she has been emotionally, physically, and sexually abused by him since I left, and that her alleged disappearance during the troubles on Ganymede are to hide the fact that he's finally killed her. The tears were flowing freely down Nicola's cheeks now, but her voice and eyes were dead as last week's fish. I don't blame anyone but myself, she said. I should never have left when I couldn't get my little girl away, too. Chapter 37 of Asarala. I don't blame anyone but myself, the teary-eyed woman said. And Avasarala stopped the feed, sitting back in her chair. Her heart was beating faster than usual, and she could feel thoughts swimming just under the ice of her conscious mind. She felt like someone could press an ear to her skull and listen to her brain humming. Bobby was sitting on the four-poster. She made the thing look small, which was impressive in itself. She had one leg tucked up under her and a pack of real playing cards laid out in formation on the crisp golden green bedspread. The game of solitaire was forgotten, though. The Martian's gaze was on her, and Avasarala felt a slow grin pulling at her lips.
Well, I'll be fucked, she said. They're scared of him.
Who's scared of who?
Ehrenreich is moving against Holden and this Meng bastard, whoever he is. They actually forced him to take action. I couldn't get that out of him.
You don't think the botanist was diddling his kid?
Might have been, but that...
She tapped on the still, tearful face of the botanist's ex-wife. Is a smear campaign. I'll bet you a week's pay that I've had lunch with the woman coordinating it.
Bobby's skeptical look only made Avasarala smile more broadly.
This, Avasarala said, is the first genuinely good thing that's happened since we got on this floating whorehouse. I've got to get to work. God damn, but I wish I was back at the office.
You want some tea?
Gin, she said, engaging the camera on her terminal. We're celebrating.
In the focus window, she looked smaller than she felt. The rooms had been designed to command attention, whatever angle she put herself in, like being trapped in a postcard. Anyone who rode in the yacht would be able to brag without saying a word, but in the weak gravity, her hair stood out from her head like she'd just gotten out of bed. More than that, she looked emotionally exhausted and physically diminished. Put it away, she told herself. Find the mask. She took a deep breath, made a rude gesture into the camera, and then started recording.
Admiral Souther, she said, thank you so much for your last message. Something's come to my attention that I thought you might find interesting. It looks like someone's taken a fresh dislike to James Holden. If I were with the fleet instead of floating around the fucking solar system, I'd take you out for a cup of coffee and talk this over. But since that's not happening, I'm going to open some of my private files for you. I've been following Holden. Take a look at what I've got, and tell me if you're seeing the same things I am.
She sent the message. The next thing that would have made sense would be contacting Ehrenreich. If the situation had been what they were both pretending it was, she'd have kept him involved and engaged. For a long moment, she considered following the form, pretending. Bobby loomed up on her right, putting the glass of gin on the desk with a soft click. Avasarala picked it up and sipped a small taste of it. Mao's private label gin was excellent, even without the lime twist.
Nah, fuck Ehrenreich.
She pulled up her address book and started leafing through entries until she found what she wanted and pressed record.
Ms. Kolinowski, I've just seen the leaked video accusing Praksidike Meng of screwing his cute little 5-year-old daughter. When exactly did UN media relations turn into a fucking divorce court? If it gets out that we were behind that, I would like to know whose resignation I'm going to hand to the news feeds, and right now I'm thinking it's yours. Give my love to Richard, and get back to me before I fire your incompetent ass out of spite.
She ended the recording and sent it.
She was the one that arranged it?
Bobby asked.
Might have been.
Avasarala said, taking another bite of gin.
It was too good. If she wasn't careful, she'd drink a lot of it.
If it wasn't, she'll find who it was and serve them up on a plate. Emma Kolinowski's a coward. It's why I love her.
Over the next hour, she sent a dozen more messages out, performance after performance after performance. She started a liability investigation into Meng's ex-wife and whether the UN could be held responsible for slander. She put the Ganymede Relief Coordinator on high alert, demanding everything she could get about Mei Meng and the search for her. She put in high-priority requests to have the doctor and the woman from Holden's broadcast identified, and then sent a 20-minute rambling message to an old colleague in data storage with a small, tacit request for the same information made in the middle of it all. Ehrenreich had changed the game. If she'd had freedom, she'd have been unstoppable. As it was, she had to assume that every move she made would be catalogued and acted against almost as soon as she made it. But Ehrenreich and his allies were only human, and if she kept a solid flow of demands and requests, screeds and wheedling, they might overlook something. Or someone on a newsfeed might notice the uptick in activity and look into it. Or, if nothing else, her efforts might give Ehrenreich a bad night's sleep. It was what she had. It wasn't enough. Long years of practice with the fine dance of politics and power had left her with expectations and reflexes that couldn't find their right form there. The lag was killing her with frustration, and she took it out on whomever she was recording for at the moment. She felt like a world-class musician standing before a full auditorium and handed a kazoo. She didn't notice when she finished her gin. She only put the glass to her mouth, found it empty, and realized it wasn't the first time she'd done it. 5 hours had passed. She'd had only 3 responses so far out of almost 50 messages she'd sent out. That was more than lag. That was someone else's damage control. She didn't realize that she was hungry until Koltyar came with a plate, the smell of curried lamb and watermelon wafting in with him. Avasarla's belly woke with a roar, and she turned off her terminal. "You've just saved my life," she told him, gesturing at the desk. "It was Sergeant Draper's idea," he said, "after the 3rd time you ignored her asking." "I don't remember that," she said as he put the dish in front of her. "Don't they have servants on this thing? Why are you bringing the food?" "They do, ma'am. I'm not letting them in here." "That seems extreme. Feeling jumpy, are you?" "As you say." She ate too quickly. Her back was aching, and her left leg was tingling with the pins and needles she got now from sitting too long in one position. As a young woman, she'd never suffered that. On the other hand, she hadn't had the ability to pepper every major player in the United Nations and be taken seriously. Time took her strength, but it gave her power in exchange. It was a fair trade. She couldn't wait to finish her meal, turning on the terminal while she gulped the last of it down. 4 waiting messages. Souther, God bless his shriveled little heart. 1 from someone at the legal counsel whose name she didn't recognize, and another from someone she did. 1 from Michael John, which was probably about Venus. She opened the 1 from Souther. The Admiral appeared on her screen, and she had to stop herself from saying hello. It was only a video recording, not a real conversation. She hated it. "Christian," the Admiral said, "you're going to have to be careful with all this information you're sending me. Arjun's going to get jealous. I wasn't aware of our friend Jimmy's part in instigating this latest brouhaha." Our friend Jimmy. He wasn't saying the name Holden out loud. That was interesting. He was expecting some kind of filtering to be sniffing out Holden's name. She tried to guess whether he thought the filter would be on his outgoing messages or her incoming. If Ehrenreich had half a brain, which he did, he'd be watching the traffic both ways for both of them. Was he worried about someone else? How many players were there at the table? She didn't have enough information to work with, but it was interesting, at least. "I can see where your concerns might lead you," Souther said. "I'm making some inquiries, but you know how these things are. Might find something in a minute, might find something in a year. You don't be a stranger, though. There's more than enough going on out here that I can wish I could take you up on that lunch. We're all looking forward to seeing you again." There was a barefaced lie, Avasarla thought. Still, nice of him to say it. She scraped her fork along the bottom of the plate, a thin residue of curry clinging to the silver. The first message was some young man with a Brazilian accent explaining to her that the UN had nothing to do with the video footage released of Nicola Molko, and therefore could not be held responsible for it. The second was the boy's supervisor, apologizing for him and promising a fully formed brief by the end of the day, which was considerably more like it. The smart people were still afraid of her. That thought was more nourishing than the lamb. As she reached for the screen, the ship shifted under her, gravity pulling her slightly to the side. She put her hand on the desk. The curry and the remnants of gin churned her gut.
"Were we expecting that?" she shouted.
"Yes, ma'am," Cotillard yelled from the next room. "Scheduled course correction." "Never happens at the fucking office," she said, and Michael John appeared on her screen. He looked mildly confused, but that could have been just the angle of his face. She felt a sick dread. For a moment, the Arbogast floated before her again, coming apart. Without intending it, she paused the feed. Something in the back of her mind wanted to turn away, not to know. It wasn't hard to understand how Ehrenreich and Nguyen and their cabal would turn their backs on Venus, on the alien chaos that was becoming order and more than order. She felt it too, the atavistic fear lurking at the back of her mind. How much easier to turn to the old games, the old patterns, the history of warfare and conflict, deception and death. For all its horror, it was familiar. It was known. As a girl, she'd seen a film about a man who saw the face of God. For the first hour of the film, he had gone through the drab life of someone living on basic on the coast of southern Africa. When he saw God, the film switched to 10 minutes of the man wailing, and then another hour of slowly building himself back up to do the same idiot life he'd had at the beginning. Avasarala had hated it. Now, though, she almost understood. Turning away was natural, even if it was moronic and self-destructive and empty. It was natural. War, slaughter, death. All the violence that Ehrenreich and his men, and she felt certain they were almost all of the men, were embracing, they were drawn to because it was comforting. And they were scared. Well, so was she. "Pussies," she said, and restarted the playback. "Venus can think," Michael John said instead of hello or any other social pleasantry. "I've had the signal analysis team running the data we saw from the network of water and electrical currents, and we've found a model. It's only about a 60% correlation, but I'm comfortable putting that above chance. It's got different anatomy, of course, but its functional structure is most like a cetacean doing spatial reasoning problems. I mean, there's still the problem of the explanatory gap, and I can't help with that part. But with what we've seen, I'm fairly sure that the patterns we saw were it thinking. They were the actual thoughts, like neurons firing off." He looked into the camera, as if expecting her to answer, and then looked mildly disappointed when she didn't. "I thought you'd want to know," he said, and ended the recording. Before she could formulate a response, a new message from Souther appeared. She opened it with a sense of gratitude and relief that she was slightly ashamed of. "Christian," he said, "we have a problem. You should check the force assignments on Ganymede and let me know if we're seeing the same things." Avasarala frowned. The lag now was over 28 minutes. She put in a standard request, expedited it, and stood up. Her back was a solid knot. She walked to the common area of the suite. Bobby, Cotillard, and three other men were sitting in a circle, the deck of cards distributed among them. Poker. Avasarala walked toward them, rolling through the hips where movement hurt. Something about lower gravity made her joints ache. She lowered herself to Bobby's side. "Next hand, you can deal me in," she said. The order had come from Nguyen. And at first glance, it made no sense at all. 6 UN destroyers had been ordered off the Ganymede patrol, sent out at high burn on a course that seemed to lead essentially to nowhere. Initial reports showed that after a decent period of wondering what the fuck, a similar detachment of Martian ships matched course. Nguyen was up to something, and she didn't have the first clue what it could be. But Souther had sent it, and thought she would see something. It took another hour to find it. Holden's Rocinante had departed Tycho Station on a gentle burn for the Jovian system. He might have filed a flight plan with the OPA, but he hadn't informed Earth or Mars of anything, which meant Nguyen was watching him too. They weren't just scared. They were going to kill him. Avasarala sat quietly for a long moment before she stood up and went back toward the game. Kotyar and Bobby were at the end of a high-stakes round, which meant the pile of little bits of chocolate candy they were using for chips was almost 5 centimeters deep.
Mr. Kotyar, Avasarala said, Sergeant Draper, with me, please.
The cards all vanished. The men looked at each other nervously as she walked back into her bedroom. She closed the door behind them carefully. It didn't even click.
I'm about to do something that may pull a trigger, she said. If I do this, the complexion of our situation may change.
Kotyar and Bobby exchanged looks.
I have some things I'd like to get out of storage, Bobby said.
I'll brief the men, Kotyar said. 10 minutes.
The lag between the Guanxi Yin and the Rocinante was still too long for conversation, but it was less than it took to get a message back to Earth. The sense of being so far from home left her a little lightheaded. Kotyar stepped into the room and nodded once. Avasarala opened her terminal and requested a tight beam connection. She gave the transponder code for the Rocinante. Less than a minute later, the connection came back refused. She smiled to herself and opened a channel to Ops.
This is Assistant Undersecretary Avasarala, she said, as if there were anyone else on board who it might be. What the fuck is wrong with your tight beam?
I apologize, Madam Secretary. A young man with bright blue eyes and close-cut blonde hair said. That communication channel isn't available right now.
Why the fuck isn't it available?
It's not available, ma'am.
Fine. I didn't want to do this on the radio, but I can broadcast if I have to.
I'm afraid that won't be possible, the boy said.
Avasarala took a long breath and let it out through her teeth.
Put the captain on, she said.
A moment later, the image jumped. The captain was a thin-faced man with the brown eyes of an Irish setter. The set of his mouth and his bloodless lips told her that he knew what was coming, at least in outline. For a moment, she just looked into the camera. It was a trick she'd learned when she'd just started off. Looking at the screen image, let the other person feel they were being seen. Looking into the tiny black pinpoint of the lens itself left them feeling stared down.
Captain, I have a high priority message I need to send.
I am very sorry. We're having technical difficulties with the communication array.
Do you have a backup system? A shuttle we can power up? Anything?
Not at this time.
You're lying to me, she said.
Then, when he didn't answer,
I am making an official request that this yacht engage its emergency beacon and change course to the nearest aid.
I'm not going to be able to do that, ma'am. If you will just be patient, we'll get you to Ganymede safe and in one piece. I'm sure any repairs we need can be done there.
Avasarala leaned close to the terminal.
I can come up there and we can have this conversation personally, she said. Captain, you know the laws as well as I do. Turn on the beacon, or give me communications access. Ma'am, you are the guest of Jules-Pierre Mao, and I respect that. But Mr. Mao is the owner of this vessel, and I answer to him. No, then. I'm very sorry. You're making a mistake, shithead, Avasarda said, and dropped the connection. Bobby came into the room. Her face was bright, and there was a hunger about her, like a running dog straining at the leash. Gravity shifted a degree. A course correction, but not a change. How'd it go? Bobby asked. I'm declaring this vessel in violation of laws and standards, Avasarla said. Kotyar, you're witness to that. As you say, ma'am. All right, then. Bobby, get me control of this fucking ship.
Chapter 38. Bobby. What else do you need from us? Kotyar asked. Two of his people were moving the big crate marked formal wear into Avasarla's room. They were using a large furniture dolly and grunting with effort. Even in the gentle quarter G of the Guanxi Yin's thrust, Bobby's armor weighed over 100 kilos. We're sure this room isn't under surveillance? Bobby said. This is going to work a lot better if they have no idea what's about to happen. Kotyar shrugged. It has no functioning eavesdropping devices I've been able to detect. Okay, then, Bobby said, rapping on the fiberglass crate with her knuckle. Open it up. Kotyar tapped something on his hand terminal, and the crate's locks opened with a sharp click. Bobby yanked the opened panel off and leaned it against the wall. Inside the crate, suspended in a web of elastic bands, was her suit. Kotyar whistled. A Goliath III. I can't believe they let you keep it. Bobby removed the helmet and put it on the bed, then began pulling the various other pieces out of the webbing and setting them on the floor. They gave it to your tech guys to verify some video stored in the suit. When Avasarla tracked it down, it was in a closet collecting dust. No one seemed to care when she took it. She pulled out the suit's right arm. She hadn't expected them to get her any of the 2mm ammo the suit's integrated gun used, but was surprised to find that they'd completely removed the gun from the housing. It made sense to remove all the weapons before handing the suit off to a bunch of civilians, but it still annoyed her. Shit, she said. Won't be shooting anyone, I guess. If you did, Kotyar said with a smile, would the bullets even slow down as they went through both of the ship's hulls and let all the air out? Nope, Bobby said, laying the last piece of the suit on the floor, then pulling out the tools necessary to put it all back together again. But that might be a point in my favor. The gun on this rig is designed to shoot through other people wearing comparable armor. Anything that will shoot through my suit here will probably also hold the ship, which means none of the security personnel on this vessel will have weapons capable of penetrating your armor, Kotyar finished. As you say, how many of my people will you want with you? None, Bobby said, attaching the fresh battery pack Avasarla's techs had provided to the back of the armor and getting a lovely green, fully charged light from the panel. Once I get started, the obvious counterplay will be to grab the undersecretary and hold her hostage. Preventing that is your job. Kotyar smiled again. There was no humor in it. As you say. It took Bobby just under 3 hours to assemble and field prep her suit. It should have taken only 2, but she forgave herself the extra hour by remembering that she was out of practice. The closer the suit got to completion, the tighter the knot in her stomach grew. Some of it was the natural tension that came before combat, and her time in the Marines had taught her to use it.
to let the stress force her to recheck everything 3 times. Once she was in the thick of it, it would be too late. But deep down, Bobby knew that the possibility of violence was the only thing twisting up her insides. It was impossible to forget what had happened the last time she'd worn this suit. The red enamel of her Martian camouflage was pitted and scraped from the exploding monster, and her high-speed skid across Ganymede's ice. A tiny bit of fluid leakage on the knee reminded her of Private Hillman. Hilly, her friend. Wiping off the helmet's faceplate made her think of the last time she'd spoken to Lieutenant Givens, her CO, just before the monster had ripped him in two. When the suit was finished and lying on the floor, opened up and waiting for her to climb inside, she felt a shudder run up her spine. For the first time ever, the inside looked small, sepulchral. "No," she said to no one but herself. "No?" Kotyar asked, sitting on the floor next to her, holding the tools he thought she might need next. He'd been so quiet during the assembly procedure, she'd sort of forgotten he was there. "I'm not afraid of putting this back on," she said. "Ah," Kotyar replied with a nod, then put the tools into the toolbox. "As you say." Bobby pushed herself to her feet and yanked the black unitard she wore under the armor out of the crate. Without thinking about it, she stripped down to her panties and pulled the skin-tight garment on. She was pulling the wire leads out of her armor and connecting them to the various sensors on the bodysuit when she noticed that Kotyar had turned his back to her and that his usually light brown neck was turning beet red. "Oh," she said, "sorry. I've stripped down and put this on in front of my squaddies so many times I don't even think about it anymore." "No reason to apologize," Kotyar said without turning around. "I was only taken by surprise." He risked a peek over his left shoulder, and when he saw that she was fully covered by the bodysuit, he turned back to help her wire it up to the armor. "You are," he said, then paused for a beat, "lovely." It was her turn to blush. "Aren't you married?" Bobby asked with a grin, happy for the distraction. The simple humanity in discomfort with mating signals made the monster in her head seem very far away. "Yes," Kotyar replied, attaching the final lead to a sensor at the small of her back. "Very. But I'm not blind." "Thank you," Bobby said, and gave him a friendly pat on the shoulder. After a few moments' struggle with the tight spaces, she sat down into the suit's open chest and slid down until her legs and arms were fully inside. Kotyar sealed up the chest as she'd shown him, then put the helmet on her and locked it in place. Inside the suit, her HUD flashed through the boot routine. A gentle, almost subliminal hum surrounded her. She activated the array of micro-motors and pumps that powered the exomusculature, and then sat up. Kotyar was looking at her, his face a question. Bobby turned on the external speaker and said, "Yeah, it all looks good in here. Green across the board." She pushed herself to her feet effortlessly, and felt the old sensation of barely restrained power running through her limbs. She knew if she pushed off hard with her legs, she'd hit the ceiling with enough force to severely damage it. A sudden motion of her arm could hurl the heavy 4-poster bed across the room or shatter Kotyar's spine. It made her move with the deliberate gentleness of long training. Kotyar reached under his jacket and pulled out a sleek, black pistol of the slug-throwing variety. Bobby knew the security team had loaded them with high-impact plastic rounds, guaranteed not to knock holes in the ship. It was the same kind of round Mao's security team would be using. He started to hold it out to her, but then looked at the thickness of her armored fingers and at the much smaller opening of the trigger guard and shrugged apologetically.
I won't need it, she said. Her voice sounded harsh, metallic, inhuman.
Kotyar smiled again.
As you say.
Bobby punched the button to call the keel elevator, then walked back and forth in the lounge, letting her reflexes get used to her armor. There was a nanosecond delay between attempting to move a limb and having the armor react. It made walking around feel vaguely dreamlike, as if the act of wanting to move your limbs and the moving of the limbs themselves were separate events. Hours of training and use had mostly overcome the sensation when Bobby wore her armor, but it always took a few minutes of moving around to get past the oddness of it. Avasarala walked into the lounge from the room they were using as the communications center and sat down at the bar. She poured herself a stiff shot of gin, then squeezed a piece of lime into it almost as an afterthought. The old lady had been drinking a lot more lately, but it wasn't Bobby's place to point it out. Maybe it was helping her sleep. When the elevator didn't arrive after several minutes, she thumped over to the panel and hit the button a few more times. A small display said, out of service.
Damn, Bobby said to herself. They really are kidnapping us.
She'd left the external speakers on, and the harsh voice coming out of her suit echoed around the room. Avasarala didn't look up from her drink, but said,
Remember what I said.
Huh?
Bobby said, not paying attention. She climbed awkwardly up the crew ladder to the deck hatch above her head and hit the button. The hatch slid open. That meant that everyone was still pretending that this wasn't a kidnapping. They could explain away the elevator. Explaining why the undersecretary was locked out of the rest of the ship would be harder. Maybe they figured a woman in her 70s would be reluctant to climb around the ship on ladders, so killing the lift was good enough. They might have been right. Avasarala certainly didn't look like she was up to a 200-foot climb, even in the low gravity.
None of these people were on Ganymede, Avasarala said.
Okay, Bobby replied to the seeming non sequitur.
You won't be able to kill enough of them to bring your platoon back, Avasarala finished, tossing off the last of her gin, then pushing away from the bar and heading off to her room.
Bobby didn't reply.
She pulled herself up to the next deck and let the hatch slide shut behind her. Her armor had been designed for exactly this sort of mission. The original Goliath-class scout suits had been built for marine boarding parties and ship-to-ship engagements. That meant they were designed for maximum maneuverability in tight spaces. No matter how good the armor was, it was useless if the soldier wearing it couldn't climb ladders, slip through human-sized hatches, and maneuver gracefully in microgravity. Bobby climbed the ladder to the next deck hatch and hit the button. The console responded with a red warning light. A few moments of looking at the menus revealed why. They'd parked the crew elevator just above the hatch, and then disabled it, creating a barricade. And that meant they knew something was up. Bobby looked around the room she was in, nearly identical to the one she'd just left, until she found the likeliest place for them to have hidden their cameras. She waved.
This won't stop me, guys.
She climbed back down, and went into the luxurious bathroom space. On a ship this nice, it couldn't properly be called a head. A few moments probing found the fairly well-hidden bulkhead service hatch. It was locked. Bobby tore it off the wall. On the other side were a tangle of piping and a narrow corridor, barely large enough to stuff her armor into.
She climbed in and pulled herself along the pipes for 2 decks, then kicked the service hatch into the room and climbed in. The compartment turned out to be a secondary galley, with a bank of stoves and ovens along one wall, several refrigeration units, and lots of counter space, all in gleaming stainless steel. Her suit warned her that she was being targeted, and changed the HUD so that the normally invisible infrared beams aimed at her became faint red lines. 6 were painting her chest, all coming from compact black weapons held by Mao Quick security personnel at the other end of the room. Bobby stood up. To their credit, the security goons didn't back up. Her HUD ran through the weapons database and informed her that the men were armed with 5mm submachine guns with a standard ammo capacity of 300 rounds and a cyclic rate of 10 rounds per second. Unless they were using high-explosive armor-piercing rounds, unlikely with the ship's hull right behind her, the suit rated their danger level as low. Bobby made sure her external speakers were still on and said, "Okay, fellas, let's..." They opened fire. For one long second, the entire galley was in chaos. High-impact plastic rounds bounced off her armor, deflected off the bulkheads, and skipped around the room. They blew apart containers of dried goods, hurled pots and pans off their magnetic hooks, and flung smaller utensils into the air in a cloud of stainless steel and plastic shards. One round took a particularly unlucky bounce and hit one of the security guards in the center of his nose, punching a hole into his head and dropping him to the floor with an almost comic look of surprise on his face. Before 2 seconds could tick by, Bobby was in motion, launching herself across the steel island in the center of the room and plowing into all 5 remaining guards with her arms outstretched, like a football player going in for a tackle. They were hurled against the far bulkhead with a meaty thud, then slumped to the ground, motionless. Her suit started to put up life sign indicators on her HUD for them, but she shut it off without looking. She didn't want to know. One of the men stirred, then started to raise his gun. Bobby gently shoved him, and he flew across the room to crumple against the far bulkhead. He didn't move again. She glanced around the room, looking for cameras. She couldn't find one, but hoped it was there anyway. If they'd seen this, maybe they wouldn't throw any more of their people at her. At the keel ladder, she discovered that they'd blocked the elevator by jamming the floor hatch open with a crowbar. Basic ship safety protocols wouldn't allow the elevator to move to another deck unless the deck above was sealed. Bobby yanked out the crowbar and threw it across the room, then hit the call button. The lift climbed up the ladder shaft to her level and stopped. She jumped on and hit the button that would take her to the bridge 8 decks up. 8 more pressure hatches. 8 more possible ambushes. She tightened her hands into fists until the knuckles stretched painfully inside her gauntlets. Bring it. 3 decks up, the elevator stopped, the panel informing her that all the pressure hatches between her and the bridge had been overridden and forced open. They were willing to risk a hole in the ship, emptying out 1/2 the ship's air, rather than let her up to the bridge. It was sort of gratifying to be scarier than sudden decompression. She climbed off the lift onto a deck that appeared to be mostly crew quarters, though it must have been evacuated. There wasn't a soul in sight. A quick tour revealed 12 small crew cabins and 2 bathrooms that could reasonably be called heads. No gold plating on the fixtures for the crew. No open bar. No 24-hour-a-day food service. Looking at the fairly Spartan living conditions of the average crew member on the Guan Sha Yin brought home Avasarala's last words to her. These were just sailors. None of them deserved to die for what had happened on Ganymede. Bobby found herself glad she didn't have a gun. She found another access hatch in the head and tore it open. But to her surprise, the service corridor ended just a few feet above her head. Something in the structure of the ship was cutting her off. Having never seen the Guan Shi Yin from the outside, she had no idea what it might be. But she needed to get another 5 decks up, and she wasn't about to let this stop her. A 10-minute search turned up a service hatch through the outer hull. She'd torn off 2 inner hull hatches on 2 different decks, so if she got it open, those 2 decks would lose their air. But the central ladder corridor was sealed at Avasarala's deck, so her people would be fine. And the whole reason she was doing this was the sealed hatch to the upper decks, which seemed to be where most of the crew was. She thought about the 6 men down in the galley and felt a pang. Sure, they'd shot first, but if any of them were still alive, she had no desire to asphyxiate them in their sleep. It turned out not to be a problem. The hatch led into a small airlock chamber about the size of a closet. A minute later, it had cycled through, and she climbed out onto the outer hull of the ship. Triple-hulled, of course. The lord of the Mao Quick Empire wasn't going to trust his expensive skin to anything that wasn't the safest humans could build. And the ostentatious design of the ship extended to her outer hull as well. While most military ships were painted a flat black that made them hard to spot visually in space, most civilian ships either were left an unpainted gray or were painted in basic corporate colors. The Guan Shi Yin had a mural painted on it in vivid colors. Bobby was too close to see what it was, but under her feet were what appeared to be grass and the hoof of a giant horse. Mao had the hull of his ship painted with a mural that included horses and grass, when almost no one would ever see it. Bobby made sure her boot and glove mags were set strong enough to handle the quarter G thrust the ship was still under, and started climbing up the side. She quickly reached the spot where the dead end between the hulls began, and saw that it was an empty shuttle bay. If only Avasarala had let her do this before Mao had run off with the shuttle. Triple hulls, Bobby thought. Maximum redundancy. On a hunch, she crawled across the ship to the other side. Sure enough, there was a second shuttle bay. But the ship in it wasn't a standard short flight shuttle. It was long and sleek, with an engine housing twice as large as that of a normal ship its size. Written in proud red letters across the bow of the ship was the name Razorback, a racing pinnace. Bobby crawled back around to the empty cargo bay and used the airlock there to enter the ship. The military override codes her suit sent to the locked door worked, to her surprise. The airlock led to the deck just below the bridge, the one used for shuttle supply storage and maintenance. The center of the deck was taken up by a large machine shop. Standing in it were the captain of the Guan Shi Yin and his senior staff. There were no security personnel or weapons in sight. The captain tapped his ear in an ancient, "Can you hear me?" gesture. Bobby nodded one fist at him, then turned the external speakers back on and said, "Yes." "We are not military personnel," the captain said. "We can't defend ourselves from military hardware. But I'm not going to turn this vessel over to you without knowing your intentions. My XO is on the deck above us, prepared to scuttle the ship if we can't come to terms." Bobby smiled at him, though she didn't know if he could see it through her helmet. "You've illegally detained a high-level member of the UN government,
Acting in my role as a member of her security team, I have come to demand that you deliver her immediately to the port of her choosing, at best possible speed. She shrugged with her hands in the belter way. Or you can blow yourselves up. Seems like a drastic overreaction to having to give the undersecretary her radio privileges back. The captain nodded and relaxed visibly. Whatever happened next, it wasn't like he had any choice. And since he didn't have any choice, he didn't have any responsibility. We were following orders. You'll note that in the log when you take command. I'll see that she knows. The captain nodded again. Then, the ship is yours. Bobby opened her radio link to Kotyar. We win. Put Her Majesty on, will you? While she waited for Avasarala, Bobby said to the captain, There are 6 injured security people down below. Get a medical team down there. Bobby, Avasarala said over the radio, the ship is yours, madam. Great. Tell the captain we need to make best possible speed to intercept Holden. We're getting to him before Nguyen does. This is a pleasure yacht. It's built to run at low G for comfort. I'd bet it can do a full G if it needs to, but I doubt it does much more than that. Admiral Nguyen is about to kill everyone that actually might know what the fuck is going on. Avasarala didn't quite yell. We don't have time to cruise around like we're trying to pick up fucking rent, boys. Huh, Bobby said. Then a moment later, if this is a race, I know where there's a racing ship. Chapter 39. Holden. Holden pulled himself a cup of coffee from the galley coffee pot, and the strong smell filled the room. He could feel the eyes of the crew on his back with an almost physical force. He'd called them all there, and once they'd assembled and taken their seats, he'd turned his back on them and started making coffee. I'm stalling for time because I forgot how I wanted to say this. He put some sugar in his coffee, even though he always drank it black, just because stirring took a few more seconds. So, who are we? He said as he stirred. His question was met with silence, so he turned around and leaned back against the countertop, holding his unwanted cup of coffee and continuing to stir. Seriously, he said. Who are we? It's the question I keep coming back to. Amos said and shifted in his seat.
My name's Amos, Cap. You feeling okay?
No one else spoke. Alex was staring at the table in front of him, his dark scalp shining through his thinning hair under the harsh white of the galley lights. Prax was sitting on the counter next to the sink and looking at his hands. He flexed them periodically as though trying to figure out what they were for. Only Naomi was looking at him. Her hair was pulled up into a thick tail, and her dark, almond-shaped eyes were staring right into his. It was fairly disconcerting. I've recently figured out something about myself, Holden continued, not letting Naomi's unblinking stare throw him off. I've been treating you all like you owe me something, and none of you do. And that means I've been treating you like shit. No, Alex started without looking up. Yes, Holden said, and stopped until Alex looked up at him. Yes, you maybe more than anyone else. Because I've been scared to death, and cowards always look for an easy target. And you're about the nicest person I know, Alex. So I treated you badly because I could get away with it. And I hope you forgive me for that, because I really hate that I did it.
Sure I forgive you, Cap, Alex said, with a smile and his heavy drawl.
I'll try to earn it, Holden answered, bothered by the easy reply. But Alex said something else to me recently that I've been thinking about a lot. He reminded me that none of you are employees. We're not on the Canterbury.
We don't work for Pure and Clean anymore. And I don't own this ship any more than any of you do. We took contracts from the OPA in exchange for pocket money and ship expenses, but we never talked about how to handle the excess.
You opened that account, Alex said.
Yeah, there's a bank account with all of the extra money in it. Last I checked, there was just under 80 grand in there. I said we'd keep it for ship expenses, but who am I to make that decision for the rest of you? That's not my money. It's our money. We earned it.
But you're the captain, Amos said,
then pointed at the coffee pot. While Holden fixed him a cup, he said, Am I? I was the XO on the Canterbury. It made sense for me to be the captain, after the Cant got nuked. He handed the cup to Amos and sat down at the table with the rest of the crew. But we haven't been those guys for a long time now. Who we are now is four people who don't actually work for anyone. Prax cleared his throat at this, and Holden nodded an apology at him. Anyone long-term, let's say. There is no corporation or government granting me authority over this crew. We're just four people who sort of own a ship that Mars will probably try to take back the first chance they get.
This is legitimate salvage, Alex said.
And I hope the Martians find that compelling when you explain it to them, Holden replied. But it doesn't change my point. Who are we? Naomi nodded a fist at him. I see where you're going. We've left a lot of this kind of stuff just up in the air because we've been running full tilt since the Canterbury. And this, Holden said, is the perfect time to figure that stuff out. We've got a contract to help Prax find his little girl, and he's paying us so we can afford to run the ship. Once we find May, how do we find the next job?
Do we go looking for a next job?
Do we sell the Rossi to the OPA and retire on Titan? I think we need to know those things. No one spoke. Prax pushed himself off the counter and started rummaging through the cabinets. After a minute or two, he pulled out a package that read chocolate pudding on the side and said, Can I make this? Naomi laughed. Alex said,
Knock yourself out, Doc.
Prax pulled a bowl out and began mixing ingredients into it. Oddly enough, because the botanist was paying attention to something else, it created a sense of intimacy for the crew. The outsider was doing outside things, leaving them to talk among themselves. Holden wondered if Prax knew that, and was doing it on purpose. Amos slurped down the last of his coffee and said,
So, you called this meeting, Cap. You have something in mind?
Yeah, Holden said, taking a moment to think. Yeah, kind of. Naomi put a hand on his arm and smiled at him. We're listening. I think we get married, he said with a wink at Naomi. Make it all nice and legal. Wait, she said. The look on her face was more horrified than Holden would have hoped.
No, that's sort of a joke, Holden said.
But only sort of. See, I was thinking about my parents. They formed their initial collective partnership because of the farm. They were all friends. They wanted to buy the property in Montana, and so they made a group large enough to afford it. It wasn't sexual. Father Tom and Father Caesar were already sexual partners and monogamous. Mother Tamara was single. Fathers Joseph and Anton and Mothers Elise and Sophie were already a polyamorous civil unit. Father Dimitri joined a month later when he started dating Tamara. They formed a civil union to own the property jointly. They wouldn't have been able to afford it if they were all paying taxes for separate kids, so they had me as a group.
Earth, Alex said, is a weird freaking place. Eight parents to a baby ain't exactly common, Amos said.
But it makes a lot of economic sense with the baby tax, Holden said. So it's not unheard of either.
What about people making babies without paying the tax? Alex asked.
It's tougher to get away with than you think, Holden said.
Unless you never go to a doctor, or only use black markets.
Amos and Naomi shared a quick look that Holden pretended not to see.